Heavenly Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you that in your grace, in the fullness of time, you sent forth your Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who are under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because we're sons, you sent the Spirit, your Son, into our hearts so that we might cry, Abba, Father. It is from the Father, through the Son, by the Spirit, that we are brought by the Spirit to the Son and back unto the Father in our adoption as your children. And that is the greatest blessing and privilege that Christians have, is to be called children of God. We're reminded by John himself in his first epistle that we need to hear that we are children of God. Indeed, we are children of God. That is what we are now. And still, what we are now is not what we will be as we await the return of King Jesus, when we behold him. And in our beholding, we are made like him because we will see him as he is. Our greatest desire, our greatest longing, God, is not to debate millennial positions, but to await the return of King Jesus when he splits the skies, when he conquers his enemies, and when he brings his people to himself, establishing his kingdom. That's what we long for. That's what our hearts yearn for. The resurrection of our bodies, the entrance into the new heavens and the new earth, and the joy, the sweetness that will be ours as we see you face to face. So God, I pray that this morning as we work through Revelation chapters 20 through 22, bringing the book of Revelation to a close, that you would be with us, that your Spirit would strengthen us, that your Spirit would convict us, that your Spirit would minister your word to us, and through the ministry of your word, conform us more into the image of Jesus. I pray, God, that we would be encouraged to know that Jesus rules, Jesus reigns, and Jesus is and will always be victorious over the wickedness and evil in this world. Help us to be mindful of that. Help us to focus in on that as we study your word together in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. So, again, when we consider Revelation chapter 20, it's as if the first question that people want to ask are questions pertaining to the millennium. And it's really interesting, right, that if you were to read through all of Scripture, the only text that explicitly states the word millennium, kilioi, I have it written in Greek and then in Latin and then in English, so you can literally see the whole movement from the Greek through the Latin into the English, which is where we get millennium, right? Kilioi, which is translated mille in Latin, which then we get millennium. So that's where we're getting even the thought of a millennium, 1,000 years. But in Revelation chapter 20 is the only explicit mention to this 1,000-year period of time. And it's interesting that even though it's only in this chapter that we get this explicit mention, we want to blow up our conversation to make it more about this point than it is about, say, what's established in Revelation chapter 21 and 22. But nonetheless, we need to talk about it. And so we've already looked at the cycles, right, through the book of Revelation. I've drawn this up on the board several times, the cyclical fashion, this recapitulating fashion of the book of Revelation, cycling through seven cycles of visions. And we've got the prologue, we've got the epilogue, and I've only listed out the first and the last cycle of visions here. So hopefully you were here at least one of the weeks previously where I had the whole thing up on the board. But if you weren't, you can come up afterwards and I'll give you the rest of the cycles. But the first cycle is chapter 1, verse 9 through chapter 3, verse 22. The last cycle is either chapter 19, verse 11 through 22, verse 5, or chapter 20, verse 1 through 22, verse 5. There's disagreement amongst commentators as to where that seventh cycle begins and ends. And the reason for that has to do with these millennial positions. It has to do with these millennial positions. We'll talk through them here in just a second. But before we get to that, I want to ask, as you've read through the book of Revelation, what do you notice in relationship to the first cycle of visions and the last cycle of visions? Is there anything that you have noticed, whether it be in comparison or in contrast to one another? So let me kind of give a guiding question, a leading question, which will be shot down in the courts, right? You know, leading question, Your Honor, strike that from the minute. Here in the first cycle of visions, where's the emphasis? Is it on the present state of John's audience or on the future state of John's audience?
I would say more present.
More present state, right? He's writing to these seven churches, seven real churches, but seven being indicative of the church as a whole. These truths that will be read in each one of these seven churches. But he's focusing primarily on the present reality of these churches, their present sufferings, the things that they need to be encouraged by, they need to be exhorted to do, they need to be rebuked. Those are the emphases in those seven churches, right? This is what I have. This is what I have for you, as it were. Well done, Ephesus. Well done, Philadelphia. But then you have those admonitions, those rebukes from Jesus, say to the church in Pergamum or the church in Laodicea, right? So that there's this primary focus on the present realities of these churches. You see that as you read through that first cycle. But it's not without a hope of something to come, right? Each one of those letters ends with, to the one who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who overcomes, this is a promise that Jesus is going to give to the one who overcomes. And many of those promises are oriented both towards the present grace that God will give to his people and the hope of the age to come. You'll see that in those promises to the one who overcomes. And that thought of overcoming is all throughout the book of Revelation. But then you get to this last cycle, and where's the primary focus? Is it on present realities or future realities? It's on future realities. See what?
The global purpose of God.
Yeah, it's this large, future-oriented, whole world kind of hope of the new heavens and the new earth, right? And so we have a present orientation, primarily, though not exclusively, and then a future orientation, though not exclusively, it is primarily oriented to this future hope, right? So you even see how John is structuring the book, right? Beginning with those present realities and then ending with a zoomed-in lens of these future realities. It's in Revelation 21 and 22 that you get the biggest and largest description of the new heavens and the new earth. This is what we're hoping for. This is what we're longing for. This is what John had been promising and even alluding to all throughout the letter, even though here at the end, that's his primary focus. So that's a general structure that we need to keep in mind. John is now orienting us towards the hope of the new heavens and the new earth. That's why there's two chapters worth of glorious realities that are described as the new heavens and the new earth. Okay. So, with that being the case, if you were to read through Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 6, it's that passage that describes the 1,000 years. So we're going to go ahead and read it, and then we'll walk through the different millennial positions, and we'll have a brief conversation without getting bogged down. So Revelation chapter 20, verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key to the abyss and a great chain in his hand. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, bound him for 1,000 years. First mention of 1,000 kilia. He threw him into the abyss, closed it, and put a seal on it so that he would no longer deceive the nations until the 1,000 years were completed. After that, he must be released for a short time. Then I saw thrones and people seated on them who were given authority to judge. I also saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony about Jesus and because of the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and who had not accepted the mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. The second death has no power over them, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. So, if you had to summarize verses 1 through 6, how would you summarize verses 1 through 6? Big picture. without getting into the nitty-gritty of your particular eschatological view, what could we all affirm from verses 1 through 6, regardless of your particular eschatological view? And when I say eschatology, are we all on the same page? It's a view of the end. And I'm using eschatology here in a cosmic way, the end of all things, because eschatology also has a personal reality to it, a personal end to one's own life. That's personal or individual eschatology. And that has to do with life and death. But this, I'm talking about cosmic eschatology. How would you summarize it? Okay, there's a reigning with Christ, right? Every view will have that kind of emphasis. There's a reigning with Christ taking place here. And if we're reigning with Christ, what does that mean? Who's not ultimately reigning? Satan's not ultimately reigning, right? He's bound, that's right. And we'll have to talk about what that means, right? But nonetheless, every view agrees that there's a binding because that's what the text says. There's a binding of Satan. So he's bound, and Christ is reigning and ruling.
And there is an at some point aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's a before and an after.
Sure. There's a before and an after. What else?
Well, that's 1,000 years.
Okay. You got 1,000 years. And regardless of one's eschatological view, the majority of commentators, whether you have a premillennial view, which we'll talk about in a second, an amillennial view, or a postmillennial view, the majority of commentators, despite where they land, view this 1,000 years as a symbolic number and not a literal number. Okay, so if one goes, well, you don't see the 1,000 years as being literal, well, that's okay, because nobody, or at least the majority of commentators in those camps, do not see it as a literal 1,000 years. It's a long period of time. Doesn't really impact one's eschatological kind of camp that you fit into. If you see it as a literal 1,000 years or a symbolic 1,000 years, it's a total period of time.
Or that's a before, after, after.
Mm-hmm.
There's a before. There's a before this Christ, this reign of Christ starts.
Mm-hmm.
After this Christ, reign of Christ starts, and mm-hmm. then after whatever that symbolic period of time is, there is a difference there as well.
Sure. So before, during, and after, right? Before, during, and after. I'd say it that way.
Well, we're not saying Christ's going to stop reigning after 1,000 years. So in a sense, not after Christ reigns.
Mm-hmm.
But
a continuation of Christ's reign.
But nevertheless, a second change.
Sure. Yep. Good.
In its nature.
So this reminder that Jesus is reigning, right? And that's been John's emphasis from the beginning. That Jesus rules and Jesus reigns. From chapter 1 all the way through the book, Jesus rules and Jesus reigns. Despite the fact that wickedness runs amok, and despite the fact that God's people are being persecuted, Jesus rules and reigns. Everything that happens in the in-between, from start to finish, is under the sovereign rule of King Jesus. Which is good news for John's audience, and it's good news for us as well, to know that Jesus reigns, that nothing is outside of his sovereign control. We looked at this 2 weeks ago, but in all of those instances of this divine passive power being given to the beast and to the false prophet and to the dragon, it's a giving of authority by God, but nonetheless a divine giving, a divine passive. So even in whatever authority the dragon, the beast, or the false prophet use or kind of rule with, it is given by God to them. Right? So he rules, he reigns, and everything is under his sovereign control.
So let me tweak my thing again.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So there's not a before this reign of Christ starts.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no not Christ reigning.
Right.
So yep. It's more like before an over and complete manifestation of Christ's reign.
Good. Yeah.
Which is a different thing from, oh, he's away, he's not reigning right now, Satan reigns right now.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite true.
That's exactly right. Which is actually the wonderful doctrine of the Ascension. It's an underappreciated doctrine that we don't talk about nearly enough, right? We talk about Christ's life, we talk about his death, we talk about his resurrection, and we stop as if that's the whole gospel. But we're missing out on a part of the gospel, which is Christ ascended on high and is currently seated at the right hand of the Father, ruling and reigning over all things. We need to remember the Ascension. It's an important aspect of our faith.
Well, the martyrs were also given a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this promise to the one who overcomes, right? Who in Revelation chapter 12 would be described as overcoming the dragon. They conquer him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. This is Revelation chapter 12, verse 11. For they did not love their lives to the point of death. Right? This willingness to give up our lives. We overcome by the blood of the Lamb and the word of the testimony. And then that looks like, what does that look like? It looks like not loving our lives even to the point of death. We have a blessing in here as well. We've actually got two sets of blessings. It's the sixth and the seventh blessing given unto those who are hearing this book being read or the one reading it. But we have this blessing. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. So it's important that we at least kind of narrow in, what is this first resurrection? John says, blessed is the one who shares in it, and then the second death has no power over them, that they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. So let me just real quick walk through the four primary millennial positions. Okay, so these are the four primary millennial positions that are described in Dr. Schreiner's notes there that I handed out to you. But we'll walk through them, and these are the four that fall within the bounds of Christian orthodoxy. So can I, let me at least encourage us in this way. Even if we don't agree on one of these, let's not label the one we disagree with a heretic, okay? Like this is the only position that would legitimately fall within the realm of heresy is full preterism, which does not affirm the physical, bodily, glorious return of King Jesus, the bodily resurrection from the dead of the saints when Christ returns. I mean, that falls outside the bounds of orthodoxy, and we cannot tolerate that view, right? But these four fall within the bounds of orthodoxy. So let's not use the H word to describe somebody who holds one of these, even if it doesn't jive with your own particular eschatology, okay?
Does that mean you can't use going to hell on
that? That's right. Now, you can hold to some of these and have other unorthodox views, but holding to one of these four does not make one a heretic. Okay? Can we at least be in agreement there that we won't use the word heretic to describe one of these four positions? So there are three primary views. I'll give the first two that were the majority position in the early church. Okay? So you had premillennialism, and you had amillennialism. Okay. Now I got to break this one down into two parts, because premillennialism has what's known as historic premillennialism.
You didn't leave enough.
I'm sorry, Ruth. Just write over some of the other things. So Dr. Schreiner has all of these described in that section right there. So
what would be the time frame?
You said earlier. Hold on. Time out. Don't get there yet. You're jumping ahead. Hold on. Time out. I'll get there. I really will. I promise. And then dispensational premillennialism.
We'll have to talk about this at home.
Okay.
I will answer that question. I promise. So those three positions right there, historic, dispensational, amillennialism, if I'm going to be honest and I want to be completely transparent, it's these views right here that are the primary views that you see in the early church. From historic premillennialism is what you see in the first century AD. Let me at least rephrase that. Early second century AD, when you have individuals writing on this particular millennialism. Amillennialism shows up at the end of the second century and into the beginning of the third century. And there's also a whole discussion as to whether or not it's Western Church or Eastern Church. The Western Church, which eventually becomes a predominantly Latin-speaking portion of the Roman Empire, it holds to initially historic premillennialism, and then amillennialism kind of comes on the scene about 75 or 100 years afterwards. Okay. So again, 2nd century AD through the beginning portions of the 3rd century AD is when you start to see these positions here. Okay? In the Eastern Church, it's predominantly an amillennial view. Greek-speaking individuals in the Eastern portion of the church argue for what is it comes to be known as amillennialism, or inaugurated millennialism. Okay? Dispensational premillennialism, at least in its form that we see today, pops up in the early portion of the 19th century. And I don't know how to get around that. That is just what the evidence displays. And sometimes dispensational premillennialism will argue for something like a 2nd century manifestation. But the reality is what that is historic premillennialism.
Okay. So what are they?
So that's a good question, but I still have one more view to articulate.
Oh, okay, sure.
Okay.
You're getting ahead of yourself.
Yeah. And then there is a position that manifests itself in the 17th century and into the 18th century. Okay. You start to see this during that period of time. And it is post-millennialism. Again, late 17th. Into the 18th century, so late 1600s, 1700s. Those are the four positions that fall within the boundaries of Christian orthodoxy. So regardless of which position you hold to, and there are going to be, like Baskin-Robbins has how many flavors of ice cream? 31, right? That's at least on the sign, 31 flavors. If you're a historic premillennialist, you probably, or at least have that label, you'll probably find 31 other individuals who have a flavor of that historic premillennialism. If you're a dispensational premillennialist, you'll find some in that camp, or like 31 different flavors. Same thing with inaugurated amillennialism or postmillennialism. You've got multiple flavors of each one of these. So I'm giving you broad categories. So if somebody says, hey, look, I fall into this category, you're still going to want to ask other questions because it doesn't give you the whole picture. Okay. But those are the four primary views that fall within the boundaries of orthodoxy. So if you hold to a historic premillennial view, try to refrain from intentionally lambasting an amillennialist. It's just not wise, okay? Or if you're a postmillennialist, which just tends to happen, postmillennialism argues that we're the view that it is triumphant in nature and everything else is kind of a weak form of Christendom. Well, that doesn't help either if you articulate your view that way. Okay? Okay. Well, let's ask ourselves, what is each one? So the prefixes are important here, right? Because each one of them have a form of millennialism, because you can't get around the fact that it's in the text in Revelation chapter 20. So this one's premillennialism, this is amillennialism, and postmillennialism. Somebody want to give a shot at what those prefixes are meant to articulate for each view? Okay. Okay, so historic premillennialism, dispensational premillennialism argue that Jesus returns before the millennium, okay, establishes an earthly rule, and then rules over that earthly kingdom for 1,000 years. After that 1,000 years, and again, most historic premillennialists will understand that 1,000 years as a symbolic period of time. They won't argue for a literal 1,000 years. But they understand it to be a complete period of time. 10 times 10 times 10, 10 cubed, right? But nonetheless, Jesus' return is before the millennium. The millennium is an earthly kingdom. And then after that 1,000 years, the end will come and the new heavens and the new earth are established. In its most general form, okay? And how that looks kind of leading up to Christ's return to establish his millennial kingdom is that there's a difference of understanding between these two camps. Okay? There's actually a pretty significant distinction between these two camps of what happens before Christ's establishment of that earthly kingdom. But we don't have enough time to get into those nuances. Okay? But nonetheless, that's premillennialism. Jesus returns, establishes an earthly kingdom. The millennial kingdom occurs under his rule, under his reign, under the reign of resurrected saints. Okay? And then after that thousand-year period of time, whether it be literal or symbolic, the end comes. The new heavens and the new earth are established. Okay. Amillennialism has an alpha privative, so most people understand this to be, oh, you just don't believe in the millennium. That's why I argued that inaugurated millennialism is probably a better articulation. And it argues that at Christ's first coming, this millennial kingdom has been inaugurated, and we are even now experiencing that millennial kingdom, but it's a heavenly rule and heavenly reign. It's not an earthly rule and earthly reign. It's a heavenly rule and heavenly reign, which they would argue is what Paul is describing in Ephesians chapters 1 and 2. So, or when it's the binding description is what Jesus himself talks about, binding the strong man, right? Or the God of this world is now cast down in John chapter 12. But nonetheless, it's a heavenly rule, heavenly reign, a heavenly millennium that has already been inaugurated at Christ's first coming and will be completed at his second coming. So that's amillennialism.
So it's already occurring.
Already occurring. That's right. That's why inaugurated would be, I think, a better term.
Question.
Sure.
From your reading, how do they explain the garbage that goes on? My hope and my belief is that heaven's been so unbelievable. To even think a glimpse of that is raining now would be. It's just hard.
Well, because they would argue that what you're seeing is the earthly reality, and the millennial reign is a heavenly reality that is occurring in the heavens. So he's ruling and reigning right now, and that heavenly rule will become an earthly reality in Revelation 21 and 22. So it's a bringing of that heavenly reality to bear an earthly reality when Jesus comes back. So they're not arguing that there's an earthly millennium. They're arguing for a spiritual heavenly reign.
With the believer who's been raised.
That's right. And then they would have to at least defend what is this first resurrection, right? So there's good point. So let me get to the post-millennialism, and then I'll argue for the two that I think have the most warrant. Okay? Post-millennialism, the prefix post, after, right? So they would argue that Jesus will return after a millennial kingdom is established on earth. And they would argue that that millennial kingdom is brought to bear through the proclamation of the gospel. The gospel going to the nations, and the gospel displaying its power and victory over the nations. And eventually, the gospel will be so powerful that the world itself will be Christianized. Now, a post-millennialist won't argue that you will be able to say at this particular point in time or that particular point in time, but they would argue that the gospel will go forth, it will be powerful, it will convert the nations, and then there will be this golden millennial rule that occurs here on earth. And after that period of time, after the millennium, which again they would argue is symbolic, not a literal thousand years, they would argue that after that, Jesus will return, and then he will establish his kingdom. Okay? So those are the four primary views. Some have more to offer than others. Okay. Some are more persuasive than others. In my opinion, and I will just throw this out there, I think the one that has the least to offer is postmillennialism. Because I don't think that does justice to the rampant wickedness and the perversity that Jesus himself describes will take place from his first coming to his second coming. It seems to me, as I read Matthew chapter 24, for instance, that there will continue to be wars and rumors of wars all the way up until Jesus' second coming. Okay. So personally, I find postmillennialism to be the least persuasive of the four.
Now, are you saying that they feel everybody's going to become?
No, they don't think that everyone will be Christian, but they will think that they argue that every nation will be Christianized. So Christianity will be the religion of the world, as it were. Not everyone will become a Christian, but nonetheless, the gospel will rule and reign over the earth. And there will be an establishment of Christian kings and Christian princes, and they will rule over nations, and they will bring to bear a Christian ethic. Okay, that's the argument of a postmillennialist. Now, let's not say, you know, we could sit there and we can go, I don't find that persuasive, but let's not all of a sudden think that they don't try to operate biblically, okay? Because they are functioning with the same biblical text that the rest of us are functioning with, and they try to make their argument from Scripture. Personally, I just don't find it to be very persuasive. It's okay. It's a ding dong ditch? So
just so long as there's not a little bag, so you
can. That's right, yeah, on fire. So, personally, like I said, I just don't find that view to be persuasive. But even with that being the case, I don't think that we should immediately assume that a postmillennialist doesn't have a biblical argument to make. I just don't find it to be a persuasive biblical argument. They're not trying to argue outside of the biblical text. They're actually arguing from the biblical text, but I just don't find it to be persuasive, personally. Okay. And there may even be someone here who's like, "Hey, wait, I'm a postmillennialist." There aren't. It was a predominant view in America in the late 17th, early 18th century. America's greatest theologian. You know who that was? Arguably, America's greatest theologian,
Jonathan Edwards.
Preached the sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." Actually caused and provoked America's first great awakening. He was a postmillennialist. He was also living during a period of time where you have individuals coming to the colonies, right? And it seems as though the gospel is taking over the world. Because as settlers were coming from England to America, they were predominantly Puritans and Christians. So you see the gospel going forth and what it might look like for individuals to live in a state where the gospel is going forth, and it seems as though it's so pervasive that the whole world is submitting to King Jesus. But America's foremost theologian, Jonathan Edwards, was a postmillennialist. So unless we want to say postmillennialists don't have their head on straight, right, then we would have to put Jonathan Edwards in that camp, and I don't think any of us would want to put Jonathan Edwards in the camp of an individual who didn't have his head on straight or wasn't thoroughly biblical. But nonetheless, if we were to sit down over coffee, and Jonathan Edwards would be a lover of coffee because he was a lover of all things good. Okay? You can see what I did there. Any of you non-coffee drinkers? We would still disagree on that point. Yeah, Sarah.
Would the argument that some people make following the postmillennialists when they believe that missionaries, you hear a missionary call or a story, and the call is made. If you don't go, how will it get done? Mm-hmm. They feel that, yes, I have to fulfill that for it to happen.
Yes, they are very much for the propagation of the gospel by way of missions. They're also very much for the establishment of Christian government so that a Christian king or prince can rule over that people. So the establishment of a Christian government. That is almost part and parcel with the postmillennialists.
Okay. I've encountered arguments for that. Mm-hmm. At a previous church, they did sort of a teaching. I don't actually remember what the class was because it was very scattered. Mm-hmm. But in dealing with this, the guy at the front basically said, if you look at history, we're looking at it from the standpoint of Jesus wins mm-hmm. versus Jesus is defeated.
Sure.
And postmillennialism is the Jesus wins view, mm-hmm. and everything else is the Jesus doesn't win view.
Until the very end.
I thought was a little simplistic.
Yeah, that's why I said a lot of postmillennialists would argue that all of the other eschatological positions are wimpy.
Yeah.
That's, I think, where he was going.
I just don't think that that's the case. I think each one of these positions would argue that King Jesus wins. It's just a matter of how is that victory being displayed and when will it be ultimately consummated? I think that none of the positions would argue that Jesus is losing at any point in time. And so, yeah, Stephen.
Well articulated, especially with, you know, God's coming, King Jesus is on the throne. I'm just a little fuzzy, and I'm aware of all these dispositions, but I'll just say the inaugurator. At what point, because the others are pretty clear, at when Christ comes back, reposed, I mean, all that, when does Christ return on the throne, coming back, all that from the inaugurator position?
Well, I would argue none of them are super clear as to when Jesus comes back.
Sure. There's obviously a point, pre-poet, you know what I'm saying?
Sure, yeah. So. With regards to the millennium, before the millennium, he's ruling right now spiritually, or he'll return after the millennium. The inaugurated millennialism or amillennial position would actually articulate a very similar understanding of what precedes Christ's coming as a historic premillennialist would. Meaning, the gospel has to go forth to the nations, right? That Romans chapter 11 would seem to articulate that there will be a large influx of ethnic Jewish individuals to Jesus such that they are grafted into King Jesus. Those are the types of things that would be both articulated by a historic premillennialist and an inaugurated millennialist. So those realities right there are held by both views. And then the difference is what happens after the return of Jesus. The historic premillennialist would argue when Jesus comes back, then he will establish the millennial kingdom. That will be an earthly reality for 1,000 years, which will then be followed by the unbinding of Satan, a great rebellion, and then the full overthrow. Right? Whereas an amillennialist would argue, no, when King Jesus comes back, that's the end of all things. There isn't going to be a final rebellion. He will crush the nations and the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet when he comes back.
So if pre-post-ah is based on at what point does Jesus show up with regard to the millennium, amillennialism is post-millennialism in terms of he shows up after whatever they've defined the millennium to be.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah.
You can't use that word because somebody else is using it.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of similarities between the two, only post-millennialism argues for a progressive improvement in what we see around us, where an amillennialist would at least acknowledge that there is a progressive increase in wickedness up until the time of Jesus' second coming. Okay. So, and see, we laugh about it. We laugh about it. We think that some of these positions are laughable. But again, let's remember that each one of these positions are trying to make their case biblically. And no one particular position is without problems. Right? No one position is not without their problems. So, for instance, and let me go ahead and give you the one. So, if I'm not, I'm least, oh man, I told you we wouldn't spend all this time on it. We spend all this time on it. If I'm least, thanks, Noah. Appreciate that encouragement. If I'm least persuaded by postmillennialism, I am second least persuaded by dispensational premillennialism. And then, for me personally, historic premillennialism and inaugurated millennialism, I think, have the best to offer biblically. Those are the two positions that. One, they have, I think, the best biblical text to warrant the positions. And two, not only do they have the best biblical texts to warrant the position, but also they're the most historical. Okay? They've just been around from the early time of the church on. Now, that doesn't necessarily make it right, nor does something that comes up later on in history make it wrong. But nonetheless, I'm most persuaded by these two positions. Okay?
What is it about the dispensational? Oh, sorry.
Do what?
If Joseph Smith comes up with a new plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. New things tend to, novel isn't always better, right? Go ahead.
What is it about dispensational, whatever that happens to be, that is unpersuasive?
So there's also, dispensationalism has a whole framework of how it reads Old Testament in relationship with the New Testament, which is not necessarily the case with historic premillennialism. It argues for a removal of the church followed by 7 years of tribulation, followed by the return of Jesus to establish an earthly kingdom. And then what happens in that earthly kingdom is kind of debated amongst dispensationalists. Not everybody is in agreement as to what even occurs there. But for me, the least persuasive aspect is this strong distinction between Israel and the church, where we see Old Testament promises being fulfilled in the New Testament in the church itself. And I think the best way to read scripture is New Testament interprets Old Testament. And so that's just not the way that a dispensational reading typically works. Again, I paint that in broad brushes, so not everyone's going to agree with that, but you have multiple forms or flavors of dispensationalism, so classic or traditional dispensationalism does hold to that view. So, and again, you could go, well, I don't hold that view, and I'm a dispensationalist. Well, that's why I'm trying to give broad pictures. Not everybody's going to agree with that particular description, although if you read dispensationalists, you're going to kind of find that particular argument.
Okay.
So, I say that knowing that there are dispensationalists this morning here. So it's like, that's why I'm not persuaded of it personally.
Because of how it reads the Bible as a whole.
It's not just an eschatological view, it's a whole hermeneutic. It's how you read the Bible.
Yeah, but you just said a minute ago, you read the Old Testament in light of the New Testament,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to be...
How the New Testament authors read the Old Testament.
What? Say that again.
How the New Testament authors read the Old Testament.
Is there a theologian that's dispensational fundamentalist that would state his view a little more clearly that we could go to?
Oh, man. So you're going to find individuals who articulate a form of dispensationalism differently. So you've got classic, traditional, and progressive dispensationalism. Okay. So a classic dispensationalist would be a guy like Darby. Jay and Darby.
He's not the most current.
He's not the most current, but he is the most classic.
Michael Locke is probably the most articulate for the day.
He's a progressive dispensationalist, though. So she asked about traditional, or at least the different forms. So if you're still a traditional dispensationalist, you've got Darby. Block or Bruce Ware, they're also articulate progressive dispensationalists. But you still have individuals who hold to traditional, classical, or even progressive dispensationalism. Right? So that's the challenge, is you still have those three views that still fly under the banner of dispensationalism. So when you're trying to describe the position, you have to say, here's this one, here's this one, and here's this one, right?
But the main thing is, God says be ready.
That's right. There we go. Ruth, thank you for bringing us all back to the main thing, right? So, nonetheless, in every single case, we're to be ready, right? There is still so much more that could be said about this particular topic, okay? But with that being the case, we have got to move on, because if we don't, we won't even hit the new heavens and the new earth, and that's really what we want to describe, okay? So look at Revelation chapter 21. After the passing away of the old age, the old earth, okay, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. So the first heaven, the first earth, the heaven and the earth that are associated with this age, they pass away, they are no more, a new heaven and a new earth is established. I also saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. The new Jerusalem is likened to the bride. So is the new Jerusalem a place or a person? There we go. The answer is yes. It is both, right? The people and place of God is described as the new Jerusalem, a heavenly Jerusalem, a heavenly Mount Zion. And it's coming down from heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. And then John, he hears a loud voice from the throne. Look, God's dwelling is with humanity, and he will live with them. They will be his people. They will be his peoples, plural. And God himself will be with them and will be their God. This great hope of the Old Testament, that God will be with his people. His people will be his, and he will be theirs, is ultimately fulfilled in the new heavens and the new earth. That is what this great hope, this great longing, this great reality is pointing towards. The fulfillment of this covenantal blessing. And then that is the reality which flows all of these other blessings. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Grief, crying, and pain will be no more, because the previous things have passed away. We look forward to verse 4 without remembering verse 3. Like, we want all of these things in verse 4, But we don't remember that they all flow from the reality of verse 3. What's verse 3? God is with his people. That is the greatest blessing of the new heavens and the new earth. These other things, they're wonderful. But they can, no tears, if you think about this just for a second, no tears, no grief, no pain. We experience some of that in part even now. If you were promised, you will never cry again. There will never be a tear in your eye. You will never die. You won't grieve. No crying. No pain. All of it's gone. But God isn't there. Does that sound good to you? Well, no, it shouldn't.
It's a slight improvement.
It's a slight improvement, but it is not the greatest of all blessings. Right? The greatest of all blessings is God's presence with his people. Immediate presence. God's presence with his people. And these are the things that come along with God ruling and reigning fully and finally. These are all blessings that come from that. But the ultimate and greatest blessing is God's presence with his people. And that should be our ultimate desire. All of these, it's like it's the icing on the cake, right? We get to eat our cake and have it too at that particular point in time. God is with us. We enjoy the presence with him, and all of these other things come along for the ride. And then verse 5, then the one seated on the throne said, look, I am making everything new. Making everything new. Everything that was bad is being made new. All of the sin and wickedness is being overcome, and everything's being made new. You're made new. I'm made new. This world is made new. Everything that's been broken by sin is made new. New and whole. As far as the curse is found, that's what God is making new. Right? And then John's told, write, because the words are faithful and true. These are good, true, and faithful words. They need to be written down. They need to be written down for God's people, both in John's day and in our day. Right? Then he said to me, it is done. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will freely give to the thirsty from the spring of the water of life. Just an allusion back to Isaiah chapter 55. This free giving of water of life, a water that flows from the garden in Genesis chapter 2, and a water that will flow from the temple, which is actually going to be described in Revelation chapter 22. The one who conquers will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. So verse 7 there, the one who conquers will inherit these things, I will be his God, and he will be my son. All of these wonderful promises are contingent upon what? Belief. But who are they given to? The one who conquers. There's a perseverance that is necessary, but it's a perseverance that is guaranteed by the Spirit who indwells God's people. It is necessary, but it is guaranteed by the Spirit who indwells God's people. So we can't say, there is no need for perseverance. Verse 7 would say, the one who conquers will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But notice the great blessing that comes to the one who perseveres. What is it? I will be his God, and he will be my son. Do you hear the familial language that comes along with that? We are sons in the Son, and his status as natural son gives us the ability to become adopted sons. Are you going to say something, Steve?
No.
Okay. So this wonderful truth that occurs, right? Now catch this. It's the one who conquers who will inherit these things because, verse 8, the cowards, faithless, detestable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their share will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. The second death is what? Hell. It is experiencing the wrath of God forever and ever and ever. A second death where you actually don't die, but you wish you could. And verse 8 says, cowards, faithless, detestable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars. That's their place. This is those who, they're defined by these things. Okay? You're defined by cowardice or faithlessness or detestableness. Their share will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur. Now, chapter 21, verse 9, all the way through the end of the chapter, describes the city coming down from heaven. And how is it described? If you just had to generally describe it, what would you say?
Here comes my house.
It what?
Here comes my house.
That's right. It's this wonderful city that's descending from above, right? It's really, I mean, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. He then carried me away in the Spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city. Now, again, is this city a person or a place? What was the answer, Sally?
Yes.
The answer is yes, right? Because I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And then what does John see? He sees a city descending down. So it is a person, it is a place, it is both. It is yes. The answer is yes. But one of the things I want to point out is when in verse 10, John says, he then carried me away in the Spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem. That's a reference back to Ezekiel chapter 40. If you go back to Ezekiel chapter 40, Ezekiel's taken up onto a great high mountain. And then what does he see? He sees the temple. It's as if John is saying, Ezekiel's vision in Ezekiel chapter 40 is becoming a reality here in the new heavens and the new earth. Show me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And it is glorious. It is a glorious city. How many gates are there? Okay, there are 12 gates. The names of the 12 tribes of Israel's sons were inscribed on the gates. How many foundations were there? 12. 12 foundations. The 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb were on the foundations. What's that a picture of? What's that pointing to signify? In this city, who will dwell? The people of God. Old covenant saints, new covenant saints, old covenant saints represented by the fact that each one of the gates has the name of the 12 tribes on it, and the 12 foundations have the names of the apostles on it, the representatives of the old covenant and the new covenant. And in this city is the people of God, old covenant people of God and new covenant people of God alike. And then this wonderful, beautiful description. The one thing that I really want us to kind of key in on, the city, this is verse 16, is laid out in a square. Its length and its width are the same. He measured the city with a rod, a 12,000 stadia. Its length, width, and height are equal. Anybody have a translation that tries to actually give us the dimensions in a way that we can understand with the 12,000 stadia?
1,380 miles.
Okay, say that one more time.
1,380 miles.
1,380
miles.
1,500 miles. So depending on the length of a stadia, which is not universally agreed upon, but nonetheless, 1,500 miles. 1,500 miles. City is laid out in a square. Its length and its width are the same. He measured the city with a rod. Its length, its width, and its height are equal. Now, how many cities do you know are measured by its height? Well, this one is, and it's all the same. But what does that remind you of? The same height and width and length. It's a perfect cube. What else in the Old Testament was a perfect? The Holy of Holies. It was the Holy of Holies that was a perfect cube. And here, the city coming down from heaven is a perfect cube. Who dwelled in the Holy of Holies? God himself dwelled in the Holy of Holies. Who's going to dwell in this Holy of Holies that is bigger than the tabernacle's Holy of Holies, the temple's Holy of Holies, but actually fills up what would have been the Hellenized world at that particular point in time? God himself will dwell with his people. It's a picture of, and again, 1,500 miles would have been what was relatively, at least most commentators would argue, what was known of the Hellenized world. 1,500 miles wide, 1,500 miles in length, 1,500 miles high. That's way out into space. But nonetheless, that's the description of the city as it's coming down from heaven. And then it's just described with 12 different stones, 12 different jewels, right? And we could walk through there, but what else had 12 jewels on it? The ephah, the high priest. Yeah, the breastplate of the high priest. It's just this description of God's presence with his people and the beauty that's contained therein. 12 gates or 12 pearls. The individual gate was made of a single pearl. The main street of the sea was pure gold, transparent as glass. And you begin to even recall, as it were, the vision that John saw in Revelation chapter 4, right? Of the throne room. And that being applied here in Revelation chapter 21. Now, did this city have a temple?
No.
No, it did not have a temple. Why? Yeah. The Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. Right? The temple was where the old covenant people of God went to meet with the Lord. And here, this city does not need a temple as if somehow it's distinct from the city, because God is with his people. He's with them. There's no temple needed there, because the Lord, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. Some would argue that there's no water, no sun, no moon in the new heavens and the new earth, from verses like verse 23 in Revelation chapter 21. It says, the city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, because the glory of God illuminates it, and its lamp is the Lamb. Does that mean there is no sun or moon? No, it doesn't mean that there is no sun or moon. It just means they're not needed in the function that they were previously. It's being made new, as if now we get to see and behold the sun and the moon for all of the glory that they actually are, being created aspects of God himself. He's made them new as well. Now, why do you have gates in Old Testament context?
Protection.
These gates, verse 25, they're not functioning in that protective way, right? Because what's going on in verse 25? They never close. They're always open, because the city is always protected, because God and the Lamb are there. We're present with God himself, and when God is present with his people fully and finally, we need not fear anything. Not because we have a king who's ruling and reigning and there are still legitimately evil people roaming the outside of the city, but because those evil people have been cast off into the lake of fire and God's enemies are fully and finally vanquished. We are secure in the city. Go ahead, Sarah.
Does it allude to how many are there?
Allude to?
In the city. How are we to reconcile the mass of this property with the narrow gate?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, for one, I think that the description of the size is a symbolic description, right? It's as if the whole world has become God's city. Okay. But as far as the numerous individuals that you would read, say, from Revelation chapter 7, right, where there is a multitude from every tribe, nation, people, and language, which no one could number. That, in comparison with the narrow gate, the reality of Jesus describing the narrow gate does not exclude a multitude of individuals who are worshiping with him. But he does seem to indicate that the way is broad and easy. Many go to destruction through it, right? But the way is narrow that leads to life. It would seem as though, if you just compare those two, that even though there is a great multitude in the new heavens and the new earth, I don't want to be the one to kind of judge how many people are experiencing eternal bliss with God and how many are experiencing eternal torment in his presence of his wrath. But if you just take that parable where Jesus talks about the broad and the narrow gate, it would seem as though many are going unto destruction and few are finding the narrow gate.
This is after the judgment. Mm-hmm. Is right. So
sure.
whoever he has deemed worthy and like, that's the ones he's talking about now. Is that?
Yes. This is in the new heavens and the new earth. This is after the resurrection. Yes. This is now after Christ has fully consummated his kingdom. Yep.
Yeah. So they've already been judged. And
Now, who is it that is in the actual city? Now, John will describe this in a few different ways. It's those who have had their names written in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundations of the world. And those who've had the names written in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world, they're also the ones who overcome. So again, overcoming, persevering is necessary, but it's also guaranteed because it's grace upon grace. The Lord is the one who ensures that all who've had their names written in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world will make it into the city. And everything that's necessary in the in-between will be fulfilled.
Because God and the merger of the ones who have gone on to heaven as well as the earthly ones will be there.
That's right. That's right. And so 1 Corinthians chapter 15 describes the return of Jesus in this way. So those of us who are alive when Christ returns will be transformed in the twinkling of an eye, right? Our lowly bodies will be made glorious, right? And those who've died will be resurrected into glory. And at that point in time, there will be this wonderful conflagration of all God's people in God's world as God reigns and rules over them as king. Okay. 22 verse 1 through 5 is just this description of this water flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Again, it's a reference back to Ezekiel chapter 47. But notice too, verse 1, it's flowing from the throne of who? God. And of who? The Lamb. So who sits on the throne?
Both.
There we go. Right. This is a clear picture of deity. The Lamb, God as well, sitting on the same throne, sharing the same power, the same authority. Goes down through the city. There's a tree of life that's on both sides of the river, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. It's as if life is, this is where life is. This is where healing is found. It's in the city of God, where God rules and God reigns. There will no longer be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will worship him. Notice verse 4. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. Kind of the same description as the high priest wearing the turban and the name of Yahweh on the turban itself. We will have God's name on our foreheads. But even more than that, who will we see face to face? God himself. We will see God himself face to face. Which that brings up a whole host of questions as to how does the invisible God manifest himself so that we might see him face to face. But we'd love to have that conversation, but we just don't have time. Night will be no more. People will not need the light of the lamp. These are all kind of echoes of Isaiah chapter 60 and Zechariah chapter 14. If you want to know, where is John getting this imagery? Well, he's seeing it, but that imagery was itself used previously in Isaiah chapter 60 and Zechariah chapter 14. Okay. Night will be no more. People will not need the light of the lamp or the light of the sun, because the Lord will give them light and they will reign forever and ever. And that's the end of this final vision. The epilogue begins in verse 6. But nonetheless, notice where the ending lies. Is there an ending to this seventh cycle, as it were? Does it have a conclusion? Does there have a point in time where this, the realities of this last cycle end or conclude? Forever and ever. That's where it ends, which is to say never, right? We will reign with the Lord our God forever and ever and ever. And then the epilogue, we have two more blessings contained in the epilogue, and we have this reminder to persevere. It's call to perseverance. It's call to come in verse 17. Okay. So much more that could be said there. I apologize for taking too much time on this issue up here. It just seems as though that's the one thing that people have the most questions about when we're talking about Revelation chapter 20, so I assumed that that would probably be the case as we gather together this morning. Okay. If nothing else, just remember what we talked about at the very beginning. Jesus coming back gloriously, bodily, and when he returns, he will raise us up from the dead, and we will be made like him because we will see him as he is. And regardless of which position you hold, let's not lump individually. Even though I don't find certain positions persuasive, I don't ever want to call a brother or sister who holds those positions somehow unorthodox. That's just, that's not fair. It's not fair, nor is it even right to call them unorthodox, because these are all orthodox views. Now, some who are unorthodox have held these views, but this, any one of these four views in and of themselves does not make one unorthodox. So let's be careful that we don't describe a position in a way that would seem to indicate that it is an unorthodox view. Okay? And if you want to come up afterwards, we can have more discussions on the different millennial views. But that's the book of Revelation in a nutshell over the course of several weeks. Next week, we are not going to have Plan and Promise first service, but we will have study second hour, and it will be through 1 Timothy. We're going to spend 10 weeks in 1 Timothy, and Forrest is going to lead us through the first several verses of 1 Timothy next week. Okay? So second service is when we'll study through 1 Timothy. There won't be plan and promise first service. Okay? All right, let's pray. And then if you want to come up and chat a little bit more, I will be out here. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the goodness of your word to your people. And God, I do pray that we would be diligent to seek your face in your word. And I pray, God, that in matters where we might disagree on eschatology, I pray that that would not cause division, that would break fellowship amongst your people. This is a third-order matter in most cases. And God, I pray that we would joyfully unite around the central truths of the physical, glorious, bodily return of King Jesus and our delighting in him as he rules and as he reigns. And as your word reminds us, as we reign with him forever and ever. So God, I pray that we would be encouraged by your word, that we would even be challenged by your word to press in more deeply into your word. And God, I pray that we would also have a humility about us as we do so, that we would not seek to vilify a different position, or that we wouldn't somehow seek to paint a brother or sister in the worst light as it relates to an eschatological view, but that by grace we would walk together, faithfully waiting for the return of Jesus, even if we might disagree on how that will play itself out. So God, I do pray that you would be with us, that you would guard our hearts and our minds, and that you would establish unity even in spite of disagreements that we might have on eschatology. So God, would you delight to strengthen us and glorify your name through us? We ask in Jesus' name.